This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Ofu, and here's what's coming up.
Without direct evidence, without any investigative capability and mandate, and in the face of vehement denials, it is difficult for any structure to confront such activity.
That was South African President Cyril Ramaphosa testifying on the challenges of fighting official corruption. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The sudden death of Chadian President Idris Deby has unleashed anxious speculations about how leadership change will affect the joint fight against terrorist groups in the Sahel region, like Nigeria's Boko Haram. France is backing the new transitional government, assuming it is capable of securing stability in Chad. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained the concerns about regional security to VOA senior analyst Mohamed Elshenawi following Deby's death.
The main reason is that the Chadian military, at 30,000 strong, is the largest in the Sahel, and it's considered the most capable, and it has been very willing to take the fight to these violent extremist groups. So it's a key contributor to a number of the regional security initiatives. However, I think it's important to point out that, you know, this narrative overlooks the fact that Chad itself has been a highly unstable country under the 30 years of Deby's rule. You know, there have been armed opposition groups, coup attempts, and periodic attacks on the capital and N'Djamena. And indeed, you know, we shouldn't overlook, you know, Deby's death is a result of the instability that had been stirred up under his long rule in Chad. And so there are a lot of pent-up grievances. You know, there's a 47% poverty rate in Chad. There's high levels of inequality, you know, perceptions of corruption. And Chad ranks, you know, 187th out of 189 countries on the Human Development Index. So this notion that there has been this great bastion of stability under Deby, I think is a misnomer. And it, you know, that conflates longevity with stability. In fact, you know, Deby has presided over a very unstable regime. And I think with his passing, we'll continue to see instability within Chad.
France backed the military council as a transitional government in Chad to maintain stability. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's a move that really bears further introspection. Chad has been a highly unstable, you know, government under Idris Deby, even though he's been in power for 30 years. And it faces a whole array of domestic security challenges and sources of instability. When you rely on such a government for a regional security cooperation effort, it is going to be inherently destabilizing and unreliable. And so the fact that France is doubling down on this strategy, and one in which we've just seen an unconstitutional change in power, I think it portends very unfavorably for stability in the region. And indeed, we have seen a growing strength in the militancy in the Sahel. And so I believe, you know, I think Deby's death provides an opportunity for a pause and a reassessment of regional security cooperation efforts in the Sahel.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Elshenawi. In South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa says he won't make excuses for the corruption of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, and would defend the indefensible. This was part of his statement to a commission of inquiry into so-called, quote, state capture, unquote. Ramaphosa was the country's second in command for a significant part of the reign of former President Jacob Zuma, who allegedly plundered state-owned enterprises. Darren Taylor has more.
Ramaphosa acknowledged the ANC heard rumors early in Zuma's presidency that two Indian businessmen brothers, Atul and A.J. Gupta, were advising him who to appoint and where.
One of the earliest claims made within ANC structures of the possibility that members of the Gupta family may have had an improper role in the functioning of the executive was a statement by Minister Fikile Mbalula at an ANC meeting in 2011.
Ramaphosa says he and other senior party members simply didn't realize how serious the situation was.
As the volume of evidence began to mount in the public domain, the issue of state capture became increasingly a subject under discussion in the National Executive Committee of the ANC and ANC structures.
He highlights party meetings to discuss the corruption and an anti-corruption resolution the ANC adopted at its national conference in late 2017 as evidence of its commitment to stopping graft. But political analyst Ongama Mtinka isn't buying it.
The things that he has cited were responses to public pressure. Were they good? Yes. Do they convey a message of politicians within the ANC that want to fight for the preeminence of the rule of law in general? Absolutely not.
Ramaphosa says when ANC leaders realized what was really happening under Zuma, they couldn't do much, as Zuma allies were in charge of all the state security agencies with the power to investigate his alleged crimes.
Without direct evidence, without any investigative capability and mandate, and in the face of vehement denials, it is difficult for any structure to confront such activity.
Difficult, says Mtinka, but not impossible. He points to a few ANC officials who had the courage to publicly oppose the graft. They were dismissed from their jobs. Some were even killed. So Mtinka doesn't have much time for Ramaphosa's contention that the vast majority of ANC members were and remain proactively and vehemently opposed to corruption.
How can one distance themselves from something they are directly involved in by way of creating the permissive environment for the kinds of things that they are now against to thrive?
He asks who, if not the ANC senior members, dismissed media reports exposing the alleged corruption of the Zuma-Gupta alliance as lies.
What did they do when it mattered most in ensuring that they safeguard the rule of law?
The truth, say many analysts, is that 99% of the ANC did nothing to prevent the corruption because they were either involved in it or they didn't want to lose the benefits of remaining within the warm embrace of the ruling party. On this, Ramaphosa's willing to step back just a bit.
We all acknowledge that the organization could and should have done more to prevent the abuse of power and the misappropriation of resources that defined the era of state capture.
For opposition parties, civil society groups, journalists and others, some who risked their lives to expose the criminal networks operating in government during the Zuma years, that's not good enough. Especially for a party that suspected Zuma was effectively the criminal's puppet from almost the very beginning of his presidency. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Cameroon's military says it has killed several Boko Haram fighters in clashes this week and pushed a group of fighters back into northeast Nigeria. But officials say some of the terrorists are still hiding along the border and are urging villagers to report suspects. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's military on Wednesday said its troops pushed back about 80 terrorists from Fotokol, a town on the border with Nigeria. The statement said the Boko Haram fighters were from the Nigerian town of Wulgo in Borno State. Cameroon's military said that in violent clashes, it killed several fighters, but Boko Haram escaped with dead bodies, leaving behind only two corpses. The military said it destroyed six war jeeps and seized a large arsenal, including machine guns and assault rifles. The military said Monday's operation was led by troops of the Multinational Joint Task Force of the Lake Chad Basin Commission. A military spokesperson, Navy Captain Atonfa Gemo Sirisage, said the operation freed several civilians who had been abducted by the militants. 19-year-old Zumbaisi Babali witnessed the abductions.
Ils étaient venus vers la chambre de la sœur Gilberte. On l'a pris.
Et puis he says the fighters took away his elder sister and a man with whom she was seeking refuge in their village church. He says he hid under a bench until the fighters left. He says the military took him to their base for protection. Mijiyawa Bakari, governor of Cameroon's far north region, says Boko Haram fighters are still lurking near the border and says civilians should report strangers in their towns and villages. He spoke via a messaging app from the northern town of Marwa.
Les gens ne sont pas très avertis dans les mosquées, dans les gares routières, dans les églises.
He says people should be more than ever before vigilant when they assemble at public spaces like markets, mosques, churches and bus stations. He says the military has been mobilized to be alert all along Cameroon's border with Nigeria and Chad. He says all travelers and their goods shall be systematically checked to protect Cameroon's territory from Boko Haram and any rebel group that will attempt to penetrate. Monday's attack came a week after Chad announced the death of its president, Idriss Deby. Conflict resolution specialist Joseph Vincent Tuda Ebode of the University of Yaoundé says the terrorists may have mobilized, thinking that Chad had called back its troops and there are fewer soldiers fighting Boko Haram.
L'absence du Tchad dans ces différents théâtres d'opération se fera sentir d'une manière ou d'une autre.
He says the terrorists know that Tchad, which contributes a significant number of troops to combat Boko Haram, is now concentrating on stopping its internal security threats. He says it is not yet known if the Transitional Military Council in Tchad will be as devoted as Tchad's late president, Idriss Deby, in fighting Boko Haram. He says Cameroon and Nigeria should remobilize their troops because Boko Haram terrorists will intensify attacks since they are aware that Chad has other priorities. There are about 8,000 troops in the multinational joint task force fighting Boko Haram. The task force has not indicated whether Chad withdrew its troops or not. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Boarding schools in Zimbabwe face a COVID-19 explosion now that students and teachers are back in the classroom. Even though most haven't been vaccinated, an implementation of the other preventive measures remains spotty. Andy Gondo gives us more on the story.
According to the Health Ministry's situational report, two schools in Matabele and South reported 106 cases of COVID-19, reigniting fears that schools were not ready to resume classes. Umzingwane High School and Sacred Heart Girls High School in Eskodini reported a combined 106 cases. Despite the ministry's assurances that the situation is under control, teachers' unions and others say that's not the case. Schools reopened on March 15th with students attending on alternate days as the government eased some COVID-19 restrictions. Mass temperature checks and washing of hands in all public areas remain in place. A national vaccination program is being rolled out. But teachers' unions have long raised questions on whether proper precautions were in place. Yesterday, a statement by the Progressive Teachers' Union, PTUZ, blamed the Ministry of Primary and Secondary School for the new cases, saying COVID-19 abatement equipment in schools is in dire need. The union's president, Takawa Firajo, weighs in.
The $750 million that the government allocated to schools to buy COVID equipment seem not to have filtered to the school. It seemed to have gone into private pockets. The classes in schools are still bloated, with some teachers teaching a class of about 103 students, 90 students, and this has ensured that there is no social distance. The Minister of Education has also not recruited more teachers in order to ensure a proper teacher ratio of 1:20 as encouraged by WHO. There is no right running water and schools.
Before schools reopened, ministry officials claimed they had found a high level of preparedness, a point teachers' unions reject, saying, for example, teachers, ancillary staff and pupils were not tested. Obed Masaraure of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Unions of Zimbabwe, R2s, also said schools reopened too soon.
We warned the government of Zimbabwe against the reckless opening of schools, but they didn't take heed of our call. We were pushing for mandatory testing of all those who were going to participate in the physical school ecosystem. Unfortunately, our government chose to blindly accept both learners and teachers. It is a fact that our schools are now the super spreaders of COVID-19. It is a fact that if there's a third wave, it is being brewed in our schools.
Observers say urgent action is needed, saying it will be more costly to manage COVID-19 than to prevent the spread. Meanwhile, Masaraure confirmed that demand for vaccines is sluggish.
Very few teachers have been vaccinated. There's limited access to information on the vaccination program. And there's still a lot of skepticism on the vaccines themselves. So there was need for a lot of education so that at least we have more uptake of the vaccine by the teachers.
Observers say fractious relations between the government and its workers is in part to blame for the situation. They say dialogue would help mitigate the trust deficit. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Of the many factors contributing to climate change, one of the most alarming is the destruction of forests, which produce some of the oxygen we breathe and store carbon. A report just released by the World Resources Institute warns that much of the world's forest land is endangered as never before. VOA's Adam Phillips has a report.
The World Resources Institute report focuses on global tree cover loss in 2020, specifically trees over 5 meters tall. Liz Goldman, a WRI data and research specialist, is a lead author of the study.
And in looking at the data, we found that tropical forests lost 12.2 million hectares of tree cover. And of that, 4.2 million hectares occurred within humid primary forests, which is the size of the Netherlands. Humid primary forests are old growth forests that have high biodiversity and generally have higher levels of carbon. And so it's very concerning.
That's because when forests are cut down, burned, or otherwise destroyed, carbon that was stored in the trees gets released into the atmosphere, which contributes to climate change.
And when we looked at the loss data, we found that primary forest loss in 2020 resulted in 2.64 gigatons of CO2 emissions, and that's equivalent to 570 million cars, which is more than double the amount of cars on the road in the United States right now.
Goldman adds that scientists have already seen the visible effects of carbon emissions in some of the world's wild places.
We saw things like bark beetle infestations in Central Europe and forests in Siberia burning, including a really big peat soil area, which resulted in a huge amount of carbon. And I'm sure that you saw coverage in 2019 of all the fires that were happening in Brazil.
Deforestation was especially severe in Africa. In Cameroon, for example, tree cover loss doubled in 2020 over the previous year. And in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, home to the second largest tropical rainforest in the world, 490,000 hectares of humid forest land were destroyed. But why was so much forest land destroyed? Goldman says that shifting agriculture, where people farm land until the soil is depleted, then cut down new forest land for richer soil, is a major factor. She and other researchers speculate that COVID-19 may also be partly, if indirectly, to blame.
Some things that we were thinking about include maybe urban-rural migration due to pandemic job losses. And so they could be people arriving from cities and establishing new agriculture just to make ends meet, to feed themselves and their families, as well as increases in commodity prices could be spurring agricultural expansion in the country.
Eli Hakizumwami is WRI's country manager in the DRC. He says that to save forest land, the underlying human needs that lead to deforestation must be addressed.
We cannot neglect that these forests are hosted by poor communities, and for their survival, they use part of this forest for their survival, which means that one can also provide support to these countries so that they can have other alternatives that can reduce pressure to these forests.
Liz Goldman notes that strategies to save the forests are vital to human and environmental well-being.
Some things that could help include improving agricultural practices to secure higher yields in areas that are already under cultivation so that primary forest does not have to be cleared for additional agricultural land. Also promoting access to clean energy so that people don't have to rely on charcoal as much for cooking and for energy. And then also providing economic incentives for protecting forests and also resources for effective law enforcement where that's an appropriate option to take.
The World Resources Institute report also recommends improving forest lands near cities. Doing so can reduce flooding and mudslides caused by erosion and improve air quality. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Social media giant Twitter recently announced it would open an office in Ghana. Kent Mensah reports from Accra on why the West African nation is attracting IT firms.
Ghanaian social media users were in a state of ecstasy earlier this month when the U.S. social networking service, Twitter, announced it was setting up its first African office in Ghana. President Nana Akufo-Addo described the move as excellent news. A statement by Twitter said Ghana's democratic credentials and support for free speech and online freedoms made it the company's choice. Twitter joins Google and other IT firms with offices in Ghana. But why are top IT firms like Twitter choosing the West African country instead of other African nations? Ghana's Minister of Communications and Digitalization, Esla Owusu Ekufu, says apart from good governance, the country has set high standards for doing business.
We are the envy and the toast of many countries around the world. But yes, we hold ourselves to high standards. The pull factor with Twitter here, if their business thrives, other global giants, tech giants, will also see, Ghana is not such a bad place to locate your business on the continent after all.
According to Hootsuite Digital 2021 report, there were 14.7 million internet users in Ghana in January 2020, while internet use in the country stood at 48%. Ghana also has 6 million social media users. For his part, the head of the international nonprofit Hack Lab Foundation, Foster Akugri, says Ghana's attraction for tech giants is not simply about the numbers. He said the firms have taken note that the secretariat of the African Continental Free Trade Area is located in Accra.
We are very privileged, and I always say it is the best time to be in Ghana. And today, if you talk about democracy, we have become champions of democracy. So the gateway to Africa is Ghana. And so for Twitter to have chosen Ghana, I believe is very strategic. As a multinational like that, you want to be closer to where the decisions are made.
Meanwhile, Twitter is looking to fill jobs in Ghana, including positions in engineering and marketing. All this has spurred Ghanaians to look forward to scoring another first on the continent in hopes of bringing more opportunities and development to the country. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra.
Burundian refugees in the Kavimvira transit camp close to the city of Uvira in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo held a protest today asking the UN Refugee Agency and the DRC Refugee Commission to have them return to their country. VOA Central Africa Service reports refugees said they are tired of harsh camp conditions and would prefer to return and die in their villages. Nigeria's deteriorating security situation is slowly spreading from the north to southern parts of the country. VOA's House of Service reports that in response, some states are imposing curfews. Recent violence by secessionist-minded members of the Indigenous People of Biafra movement, including killing of police, customs, and civilian security agents, has compelled the Rivers State government to impose a 10-hour ban on movement. In Anambra State, VOA Hausa reports that leaders of the Fulani community are condemning alleged killing of their members, also by IPOB militants. Long-haul truck drivers in Angola complain that health authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo refuse to accept Angolan COVID-19 tests and demand that all drivers repeat the tests in the DRC for $45. Drivers say they don't have that kind of money. The VOA's Portuguese to Africa Service reports that the World Health Organization staff in Angola says Angolan tests are internationally certified and should be accepted, but for now, trucks and cargo are backing up on the Angolan side of the border. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Chinua Ruafo in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.